Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. This morning, Jaws of Justice programmer David Bell speaks to Rika Sharma Crawford, attorney, about the secret immigration tent courts on the U.S. southern border. Rika recently traveled to the southern border and went into those tent courts to witness firsthand the ongoing struggle to preserve due process and the rule of law. They will discuss why we should be concerned. Be sure and listen. Jaws of Justice wants our listeners to know we appreciate each and every one of you. A crisis on the scale of the pandemic can reorder society in dramatic ways, for better or worse. All of society pays a heavy price for decades of failing to create a rational system of health care that works for all of us. Please take care. We will air the 420 drug war news at the end of our program. Let's listen now to David and Rika.
Good morning. This is David Bell, and you're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. I'm joined today by phone with immigration attorney Rika Sharma Crawford. Rika, are you here?
I am here.
Wonderful. Thank you. And I know we've had to institute some policies here at the studio, so our guests are appearing by phone. We're going to have a fascinating discussion that I think plays on the discussion we had, we just heard from in the prior radio show, and that is the situation with immigration, to the extent it's taken a backseat to the coronavirus scare that is ongoing right now. We're going to get into it, and I really appreciate, Rika, you joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So let's start off with, and I know I've spoken to you and your husband, Michael, who also immigration attorney, a number of times, and every time I talk to you, I always have to go through the basics of immigration because it sounds so horrifically complicated, and I still remain confused. Even though you take me to the moment where I understand it, I wind up forgetting, and so I need to your help again. So I guess the first issue is, if I want to get into the country, the United States, from somewhere else for some period of time, and I want to do it legally, what are generally the options that I have? And then we'll focus in on what's going on at the border.
Sure. So when you think of U.S. immigration, what you have to think of is that there are basically three main avenues of permanent residency in the United States. One is family-based, which is generally any family member. Well, it's typically parents, spouses, and children who are eligible to file for their loved ones. There's also a category for brothers and sisters of United States citizens. However, that one, the wait times on it currently are between 20 and 25 years, so I don't know how realistic that option is. And then after that, you have employer-based, which is an employer can sometimes sponsor you for lawful permanent residence. And when I'm talking about right now, these three avenues, I'm talking about permanent residents. I'm not talking about non-immigrants. And I'll pick that back up in a second. But when you're talking about employer-based, you're talking about an employer who says, I have a foreign worker that I want to sponsor. And then there's a number of things that that employer has to show in terms of whether or not there's an American worker who's eligible or available for that particular position. And only then can they, and that they're willing to pay a certain amount under the Department of Labor standards. And if they can meet that, then, you know, as they go through the process, then they can sponsor an employee. And then the final category of people, and of course I am cutting this like
sure,
massively, otherwise your whole show would be, this would be all, the whole thing we'd be talking about. And the third category is what's known as humanitarian relief. And humanitarian relief are things like asylum, which everybody has been hearing about now for the last 3 years. And there are things like U visas, which are specific visas for victims of crime, specified crime. And you know, there's relief under, you know, there's a variety of other forms of relief, such as under the Violence Against Women's Act, things like that. So humanitarian concerns that open up a separate avenue towards lawful permanent residence. Like I said, what I'm talking about in these three main categories are immigrant visas, which are people who are coming to the United States to live, and work permanently, and ultimately obtain their U.S. citizenship. Now, that does not include non-immigrants, which are people who are coming in temporarily, so students, visitors, temporary workers, things like that. That has, you know, that is a separate process, and that doesn't necessarily lead to permanent residence. It can, but usually something superseding has to occur before that can occur.
So let me stop you there just to make sure. And I appreciate you using these terms. Again, I always learn when I talk to you. The term immigrant, as you're using it, refers actually to someone who wishes to come to the country and remain. Am I right? Is that how you're using that term?
Yes, that's right.
So,
that's right.
And there's three main avenues, and you use the phrase lawful permanent resident. I think we've heard also the term green card holder. Are those synonymous?
Yeah, they're synonymous. Green card holder, the reason that, I mean, it's a colloquialism, but the reason that came about is because the actual cards were green. And so that's where the term green card holder came from.
Okay, and so
when you got your status, your permanent resident status, you were issued this card that was green. That's where that came from.
So just to make sure, so if I'm looking to immigrate to the United States, I can either do it, and we're just talking very general because we want to move on to your visit to the border, but we're talking about family-based. I've got some family connection in the United States. The second one, some employer-based. And the third is under just broad category of humanitarian relief. That would be the three main avenues for coming to the United States permanently, and avenues towards a green card. And then I guess once you get a green card or a lawful permanent residency, that then springboards potentially to citizenship.
That's right. And it can. I mean, there are some people who never get their citizenship, right? And when you hear in the media and you hear about, you know, politicians talk about, well, this is a pathway to citizenship, what they're really saying is that this ultimately is a permanent situation where a person can become a permanent resident of the United States and may then later decide to become a citizen. There's lots of people who never become citizens of the United States.
Okay. And then you're going to talk then about the non-immigrant category very briefly, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So that's like I was saying, is those are your visitors, your students, the people who come in on temporary workers, things like that. So their intent is to come into the United States, do whatever they're going to do, you know, visit family, attend a conference, those kinds of things. And then seasonal workers, so, you know, the people who are out picking strawberries and apples and things like that. Those are called seasonal workers, but they're temporary. And then they ultimately will leave when the purpose of their visit is done.
I see. So those are now we're to the two main broad categories. One would be the permanent, the immigrants, individuals wanting to stay here permanently, and then non-immigrants, individuals whose intention is to be here for a short period of time to complete a task, a defined task, if you will, whether it's going to school, seasonal job, some type of internship, I assume even a vacation, a tourist visa as well?
Yeah, a tourist visa will work.
Okay. And then, real quick then, if we switch gears to immigration court, what is immigration court? And the reason I bring this up to you is that usually, you know, if I get a speeding ticket, if I get charged with a robbery or I get charged with a white collar crime, I'm going to walk into a courthouse. We've all been there, seen it. We've seen juries on TV, you know, O.J. Simpson trial, whatever the trial may be. We all associate that with a court. There's someone sits up there with a robe. Those individuals are part of the judicial branch, usually appointed by someone in the executive branch, but they're a completely independent branch, a lot of times not subject to election, or if they are, it's only some type of retention-based election, so that there's a somewhat of a buffer, if you will, between the political process and the judicial process. We talk about immigration courts. Are we talking the same thing, or is it a different mechanism?
Well, before I answer that, yeah. David, I do want to provide a very specific clarification, and that is that the last thing we want to do is have people believe that just because these three broad categories exist, that it's all guaranteed. You know, we get people all the time who say, well, they've been here for 20 years. Why didn't they just get legal? And the reality of it is that there are paths that are open, but that is not a guaranteed path. And in fact, there's many, many things in the law that are there that can prevent someone from going forward. So the way that I like to explain that is that, you know, let's say you have a 16-year-old kid and he's all excited to go get his driver's license, and you get to the driver's license place and they have to take a test. Well, if he doesn't pass the test, he's not going to get his driver's license. I don't care if he's 16 or if he's 17. If he's got a prior DUI as a minor in his history, he's not going to get his driver's license. If he simply fails the test altogether, and either the written or the driving test, he's not going to get his green card or his driver's license. So, in a similar way, there are things that are minor and things that are major that can prevent a person who has an actual path forward from being able to see that fully through. And then the other weird thing in immigration law is that in every single one of these categories, you have two components that exist. So one is the legal requirement. Do you meet the legal requirement? So, like, using my driver's license analogy, is he 16? Has he taken, driver's ed? Okay. There's also this weird thing called discretionary, a discretionary component, which means, let's say that day he gets a teacher or a driver who is, testing on his driving, who just doesn't like him or doesn't like, something about him. In that way, even though he's met all of the legal criteria, that individual could simply say, in my discretion, I say you're not going to get your driver's license today. That's a really weird nuance in immigration law that people don't understand, that, it's easy to say, why didn't they just get legal? But the reality of it is a far more complicated question. So I'm going to answer your question about the immigration court, but I think it's very important that people understand that piece of it.
Sure, and let me interrupt you. Again, Rekha has been nice enough to join us from her home. We've got the policy. We're not letting guests come into the studio. And so it's hard sometimes to read cues and letting the listeners know. So I apologize, Rekha, in advance if I interrupt. But one other thing, which category do DACA students fall in of these two broad categories? And then if you could move on to the court explanation.
Sure. So the DACA ones, it's a little bit of a hybrid in the sense that it is a humanitarian form, but it is a humanitarian form that wasn't created by President Obama. Deferred action has been on the books since 1996. It's not a new thing. It is an old thing that the Obama administration used in a way that would protect or provide protection for a group of people. So in technical terms, it is a humanitarian form. It is neither an immigrant visa nor a non-immigrant visa, though, because it is not a permanent solution. And so it is a temporary stop hold, until something else changes, until Congress acts, or, somebody who's on DACA is able to take, let's say they find, they get married and they now have a spouse who can file for them, or they have an employer who's willing to sponsor them, and they meet all the other criteria, including discretion, then that may provide an avenue unto itself. But it's really neither an immigrant visa or a non-immigrant visa. It's just a true, pure, humanitarian stopgap form of relief.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. Thank you. So now let's talk courts. Help me understand why you go to court, what that court is made up of, and kind of what goes on there, so we have a good foundation for when we go down to the border to talk about your experiences.
Yeah, okay. So immigration court is an administrative law court. So for people who, other kinds of administrative law courts could be workers' comp courts, hearings in that, driver's license retention hearings, those are all administrative law. And so with the immigration court in Kansas City, and there are a number of immigration courts across the country, but ours here in Kansas City is located in the Lathrop and Gage building up on the fifth floor. It's pretty innocuous. If you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't know it's there. And there are three judges. The judges are administrative law judges, which means that they're actually part of the Department of Justice, but they are, it's kind of weird because even the Department of Justice doesn't consider them to be judges. They consider them to be low-level assistant U.S. attorneys, but yet they are empowered under the law to make life and death decisions. And they are the trial courts, if you will, but the rules of evidence don't apply. The rules of discovery don't apply. The rules of, burdens of proof exist, but generally for the government, it tends to be a very washed over burden. And generally the form, when you're trying to win your right to stay in the United States, that burden stays with the individual trying to stay, which is the non-citizen.
So let me stop you there real quick. So just to understand, first of all, you said that the immigration court falls under the jurisdiction of the Attorney General or Department of Justice, but it would seem to me, just thinking through it, that the same police people that are acting as law enforcement and prosecutors also fall underneath that same Department of Justice or Attorney General umbrella. So you've got the judges and the courts set up and run by the people that are prosecuting and doing law enforcement. That seems like rife with potential issues.
Well, before 2003, when the Department of Homeland Security was created, yes, you're right. The INS, both components, the prosecutor and the judge, were all part of the Department of Justice. Now, in 2003, when the Department of Homeland Security was created, it somewhat bifurcated that responsibility. So now you have DHS counsel who represents the interest of the government, and then you have the immigration judge who is under the auspice of the Department of Justice. So it's a little bit of a different setup now, but, 90% of the judges who are immigration judges came up through the Department of Homeland Security, that path. So, there are a lot of immigration judges who previously would have been, attorneys for Department of Homeland Security. So, in some ways, in reality, it plays out where it is slightly tilted, but in terms of agencies, they are now two separate agents.
So help me out then. What is being litigated at these immigration courts in terms of the structure that you've set out for us? There's the people wanting to immigrate here, or immigrants. There's people here that are non-immigrants. Mm-hmm. What are the typical cases that are litigated before these immigration judges?
So what you have in front of the immigration court is what you have is what's called a charging document. It's called a notice to appear. It's a very interesting creature that honestly could take up an entire hour just talking about that, which we won't do right now. But nonetheless, if you think of that charging document like a traffic ticket, it is the allegations of what the government is saying, and then once those allegations are made, you can go to court and try and defend against those allegations. So the way it turned out, or the easiest way to think of it, is that the immigration judge is trying to answer two questions. One, can the government of the United States ask you to leave? Now, that could be based on the fact that you have no status. It could be based on the fact that you have violated your status. It can be based on the fact that you were incomplete in completing your status. Or it can be because you have status. You are a green card holder, but you have done something that rises to a level that causes the government to say, okay, we want our green card back. Typically, that tends to be criminal activity, whether that be somewhat minor or it can be somewhat serious.
Okay.
And then the second question that the immigration judge is trying to answer is there any reason to allow you to stay? Is there any relief in the law that can be used as a defense to the government's position that you should be asked to leave the country?
I see. And by the way, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Rekha Sharma Crawford. We're going to get to these kind of secret immigration courts that are going on at the border with Mexico right now. But before we get there, I always like to have a strong foundation so that we understand what the issues are, and Rekha's taking us through that. Rekha, so we're talking now about what immigration courts do, and you're talking about, is there any reason, so there's a charging document like, hey, this person needs to leave because of this, and then the issue is there any reason that this person can be allowed to stay? And what generally are those reasons then? Are those the same? Well, are those the same of the categories I've already listed, or are there additional defenses, if you will, that someone can bring up that we haven't already talked about as a reason to stay?
Yeah, so a lot of this is, you know, statutorily heavy. And so please understand that I am, you know, simplifying this probably 200% because it's so easy to get into the weeds and so easy to get lost in the weeds that I'm just in trying to, in the interest of time, I'm just giving you broad brush concepts so that people have an understanding of kind of the parameters of how this works.
Sure.
But in terms of, you know, reasons to leave, like I say, there are a variety of things. Like, for example, if you come in as a student and you are working without permission, so students are generally not permitted to work other than, you know, like 20 hours on campus. But let's say you go, okay, I'm having trouble meeting my financial needs, and so I'm going to go work at McDonald's. And they go out and they go work at McDonald's for you know, minimum wage to try and help alleviate some of the financial burden that they're feeling. That's a violation of their non-immigrant status. And so it could be a reason for the government to say, look, you violated the terms and condition of your status. Now we're asking you to leave. And so in that scenario, let's say they end up in front of the immigration judge. The immigration judge is going to say, yeah, you did. You violated the terms and conditions of your status. Now, is there anything that allows you to remain in the country? Well, let's say that that individual is married to a United States citizen. That may provide an avenue for that individual to now say, well, wait a minute, I agree that I, you know, violated the conditions of my status. However, I'm married to a United States citizen who is starting the paperwork or is completing the paperwork for me to obtain my residency. So now that becomes a defense to why the individual should not be deported from the country.
I see. All right. So let's now move to, if we can, move to the border. We talked about categories. The first category, people that want to come here and remain here, immigrants. We talked about family-based, reason to stay, employer-based, humanitarian. And within humanitarian, there was the concept of asylum. Is that generally what we're dealing with at the border now that you saw when you went down to
That's right.
Go ahead.
That's right.
So what are they seeking? Who are they, and what are they seeking asylum for? What are they running from? If you could, I know there might be a number of different reasons, people from a number of different countries, but if there's one or two groups that kind of personify what's happening down there, if you could help us with that.
Yeah, so predominantly, and there are additional, I mean, ever since some of the provisions that have gone into play have come into play, you know, there are an increasing number from other countries. Now, what I generally mean by that is that typically we were looking at Central American migrants at the southern border. And when I mean Central American, what I'm talking about is El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Those were your three key countries where you were seeing an influx of migrants coming to the southern border because they were fleeing violence, whether it was gang violence, domestic violence, governmental abuses, things that put their life and their families at risk. And so they were fleeing that kind of a scenario, coming to the United States and asking for protection. Now, in its typical form, asylum laws are humanitarian forms of relief, and asylum does not require that you go to the port of entry. Or another way to think of that is it doesn't require that you walk up to the front door of the United States, knock, and say, please give me asylum. In fact, the laws say, if you are in the United States, regardless of how you got here, you are able to file or ask for asylum protections as long as you ask for that within 1 year of entry into the country. So now, of course, with some of the provisions in place, you're seeing people from Venezuela, people from Cuba, people from, you know, a lot of other countries that may have, you know, that are now in Mexico trying to go through the port of entry, go do the front door of the United States, knock on the door and say, please let me in, I'm fleeing persecution.
So before that, if I were to have come across the border, you know, illegally, the best, maybe if you could educate me on the right word to say, but going across with no ticket to get in, and then I declare, and then an agent comes up on me, an ICE agent comes to me, and I say, hey, I'm hereby requesting asylum. That is a mechanism then, or under the law, that is a mechanism then for me to start through that process.
Yeah, I mean, the law says, look, you know, if you have entered the United States without inspection, then you can still be eligible to ask for the protections of asylum. And at that point, you know, there are certain provisions in the law and a certain procedure in the law that allows the government to make a determination as to whether or not your fears are credible. It's a very low threshold at that point. And then, you know, allow you to seek that relief in front of an immigration judge.
So briefly then, before the tents were set up, is it individuals would show up at the front door, as we're saying it, at a port of entry, and announce they want, they're seeking asylum, and then they would be allowed into the country to wait until there was an asylum hearing?
So prior to the migrant, the Migrant Protection Protocol, sorry. What was happening is that, you know, it didn't matter which way you came into the country. It could be that you could come in through, like I said, without inspection, or you could go to the front door of the United States and ask for protection. Under the Migrant Protection Protocols, or more commonly known as the Remain in Mexico policy, what the administration did is they said, no, if you are seeking asylum, come to the front door of the United States, knock on the door, and let us know that you are seeking asylum.
I see.
Now, there's a variety of reasons why it was done that way. And in particular, one of the main reasons is that when you do that, when you go to the door of the United States and you knock and you say, I would like to ask for asylum, you are classified in a legal category that allows the government to take you into custody and detain you.
Versus if I came across the border not through a port of entry.
That's right. So it sounds kind of opposite, doesn't it?
Well, so, and by the way, we're gonna take a break here, but before we close, I just want to make sure the distinction, and then we're gonna get down to the border and have Rekha talk about it. Because I understand it. What you're saying is that if I wanted to, for asylum purposes, if I go up to the front door, meaning a port of entry, and knock and say, let me in, at this point now they can take me into custody, whereas the policy, whereas it had, if I come across the border, you know, in the middle of the night and requested asylum, I would not have been able to have been taken to custody. So is that the paradigm that we're going to kind of go into as we come back from the break?
That's right.
All right, wonderful. You're listening to David Bell on 90.1 KKFI. Our guest today is Rekha Sharma Crawford, and we're talking about the immigration crisis at the border. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Support for KKFI provided by Mid-America Regional Council. It's time for the 2020 U.S. Census. Every 10 years, the goal of the U.S. Census is to count every person living in the 50 states, District of Columbia, and 5 U.S. territories. Each home will receive an invitation to respond to the census either online, by phone, or email. More information on what to expect and why it is important to participate in this effort is available at 2020census.gov. If you need help, you can contact United Way by calling 211.
Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet. Hear from regional and national guests, find out about upcoming events, and learn how to keep yourself and your family well. Tune in each week from 6 to 7 on Monday evenings or listen anytime at kkfi.org/podcasts.
Now the calendar for the week of March 23rd. Usually, Corey's Network has a regular weekly meeting with a survivor's workshop on Mondays from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, the City House, 14300 East U.S. Highway 40, Independence, Missouri. The church is east of the Hy-Vee on 40 Highway. To determine if there is a meeting on March 23rd, check their website, coreysnetwork.org, use Facebook, or phone 816-866-7668. Grandparents Against Gun Violence had planned to meet Monday, March 30th, from 4 p.m. at Colonial Church, 7039 Mission Road, Prairie Village, Kansas. Park on the east lower level and enter the same level on the east side. This is a delayed date, which may also be changed. Keep checking their website, mokesgpgv.org. Midwest Innocence Project is hosting a Next Gen virtual happy hour on Wednesday, March 25th, 5:30 to 7 p.m. Go to Midwest Innocence Project on Facebook to obtain login information. This is a very abbreviated calendar this week because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Please take care of yourself and others. As of this date, KKFI has no plans to stop broadcasting. Thanks to all our listeners. Stay close to your dial and stay well. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank all our volunteers. Please listen next week. Our show will feature two leaders of Moore Square's Criminal Justice Task Force of Kansas City, Kansas, Khadijah Hardaway and Attorney David Grumman.
This is David Bell, and you're joining us with Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. Our guest today is Rekha Sharma Crawford. Rekha, we left off with, we talked about in the first 30 minutes, the different categories of how individuals can lawfully come to the United States and potentially remain. We've narrowed it down now because we're going to get to the border with Mexico and your visit there to immigration court set up in tents, it sounds like, and I know you'll get into that. But we're talking about the two different ways that you could request asylum. One was that you go up to the front door, if you will, to port of entry, say, hey, I'm here, I'm requesting asylum. The other one was to go illegally across the border, say, I'm requesting asylum. And you're saying that the treatment of individuals in the same situation in terms of a threat from back home, that they're actually going to be treated differently by the government, if you could briefly explain that.
Well, actually, it's not only this by the government, it's in the law. The law says that if you are found in the United States and you ask for asylum, that's permissible. And, you know, there is no specific requirement that says that the person must go to the front door, but the law does treat disparately people who are found in the United States and people who are sitting at the front door of the United States. So, yeah, I mean, I think the issue here becomes is that's where the MPP policies came from, is they said, okay, we're going to force everyone to the front door because it gives us greater leverage in terms of how we treat the individual and the rights that they are afforded.
How is the policy forcing them to the front door versus trying to get over the border without going through the front door? What's the motivation or the stick, if you will, to get people to funnel through the front door?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is that on the southern border, what has happened is that the classification of whether you are found in the country without permission or you are found at the front door is of little meaning. And so what they have done is they have said, we don't care if you came across the Rio Grande and are entitled to different rights versus someone who's standing at the front door and is coming in through the front door, we're still going to treat you exactly the same, which is we're going to push you back to Mexico and make you wait there. Now, it's not legally sound, but it's convoluted how they have gotten there. But at this point, you know, people were trying to do the right thing By coming to the port of entry. And historically, I will say that historically, when you came to the port of entry, knocked on the door, were found to have a credible fear of or a reasonable fear of persecution, they would let you in, allow you to wait for your court date, because, you know, otherwise, how are you going to get your hearing notices? How are you going to go to court? There was these functional kind of issues that would come up. And so historically, no one anticipated that they were going to push everyone back into Mexico, into these tent cities that exist. And so people were trying to do the right thing. They said, okay, you want us to come to the front door? We'll come to the front door.
I see. And so is it almost a credibility? You're given a more credibility if you showed up to the front door and knocked and said, listen, I'm in trouble, versus run across the border, get caught, and say, I'm in trouble?
I mean, I don't think that was it. I don't think it was a credibility issue. I think the issue was is that, you know, when you go in and at that port, at that point, when you ask for protection, you have to kind of give them some basis for asking for that protection, which is reasonable, right? So the laws allow for the officials, immigration officials, to question you, to say, okay, tell us what the basis of your fear is. Tell us what the basis of what you're fleeing and what you are afraid of returning to. And as long as you could provide a reasonable basis that was credible and the officer believed that, then what they would do is they would say, okay, we're going to let you go in front of an immigration judge, present your case, and then let the immigration judge make the determination whether or not you have met your burden for asylum.
Okay. And so now, so what's the reason then to set up the immigration courts in tents? What's the purpose of that then?
So let me set this up a little bit, David. So one of the things that I kept hearing over and over and over again is from my colleagues who are on the border frontline. I don't know how they're standing, but they were sounding the alarm bells, saying, look, you know, this is a due process nightmare. These hearings are not real hearings. These court proceedings are not real court proceedings, that there's just so much going on. And there was no one really covering it here in the Midwest. And I felt like, well, we should probably, we're hearing about all of this stuff going on at the southern border. I wanted to go down and see it firsthand. And so when I went down, I was working with a colleague of mine down there who was basically, you know, showing me around, letting me kind of observe with her what was going on, because you couldn't get into these tent courts without having a live case. So I had to actually enter my appearance for an individual before they would even let me into the court. I think they have changed some of that now, but there's also a reason for that, and I can go into that in a minute. But when I went down, it was disturbing to see, number one, the cities that had been set up just on the other side of the border. So this is I went down to Brownsville, Texas, and so the other side of Brownsville, Texas is Matamoros, Mexico. And I went down in early to mid-December of last year. And when I got there, I mean, it was so disturbing in terms of seeing these tents. You'd cross over onto the Mexico side, and immediately there were all of these tents that were were there. Now, those tents came from nonprofits that had been down there trying to help the migrants because they didn't have any place to stay. And so what has happened is that the government of the United States entered into an agreement with Mexico to pay them to keep the migrants in Mexico. And so people would come in, they would say, I would like asylum. They would say, okay, fine, you've passed your reasonable fear interview, now go wait in Mexico for your court date. And so in order to deal with all of these individuals, rather than set up, you know, have them go to court in, let's say, L.A., or go to court in Harlingen, or go to court in Brownsville, what they did is they set up these giant tent courts in the CBP parking lot. So it's as if that court is at the border or at the front door of the United States.
You said CPB. What does that stand for?
Customs and Border Patrol.
And you're talking about an actual like physical like asphalt parking lot, and they put up tents like a, well, I'm just imagining what like you'd put up a, like you go to a, I don't know what, four poles and a cover on top of it type of a tent.
A circus tent.
Hmm. And what goes on in there? Do the judges sit in there? The prosecutors sit in there? Are they physically there, or how does that? What, how, if you could describe inside this tent?
So when you go into this tent, number one, it's highly regulated by security, and I mean over-regulated by security. No one can walk from any place, that includes attorneys, can go from point A to point B without an escort. So if you have to, as an attorney, have to go to the restroom, you have to have an escort walk you to the restroom, the porta potty, and then that individual will wait outside of the porta potty until you're done, and then they will walk you back to wherever you needed to go. That's how highly regulated it is. They are a series of what are those called? The storage boxes. Or, you know, you remember in the old schools, they used to have those storage boxes. You could, you know, container boxes.
Sure.
And you could then, they would turn into classrooms and things like that.
Sure.
So it's, those are the types of these giant containers, if you will, that have been converted into courtrooms and then have been converted into meeting rooms for the attorneys.
And are there judges in the courts? I mean, are they physically there? They come out in a row behind a bench?
No. The judges, so what happens is that, first off, when you go into the court, all the attorneys have to give up all of their equipment. So no laptops, no cell phones, no iPads, nothing. You have paper and pen, and that's about it. And then what happens is that you're escorted basically into this waiting area, and then you go from the waiting area into the courtroom. And I say courtroom, but it's really this giant 2x double-wide container room that has lines of chairs in it, that has migrants that have been sitting in there. And then they have a big giant TV screen on the front wall, which is where the judge and the government's lawyer, DHS counsel, appear televideo. And those two individuals could be anywhere in the country. So generally it could be, you know, like in Brownsville, there was a lot of the cases that were coming where the judges from Harlingen, which is about 30 minutes away, and that's where the judges were seated along with DHS counsel.
So you
can't see the government's lawyer. You can only see the DA. You can only see the judge, unless, of course, the judge moves the camera so you can see the attorney in the room.
I see. And actually, you're seeing a judge. You're hearing this judge speak to you, and then off in the distance somewhere, you're hearing this voice of the who essentially amounts to the prosecutor. You're just kind of hearing that off in no man's land. I mean, just coming from speakers somewhere.
Yeah, and the other thing that I found that was just remarkable is that, so the judge, you know, when they would conduct these hearings, they would conduct them in English. Now, there was a translator present, but the judge would say, well, hold on, let us, you know, we will go through your hearing, and then at the end of it, the translator will surmise what has kind of happened and give you a little bit of a briefing on what we've done and what has occurred.
Let me stop you there. So usually in court, when I represent individuals who need an interpreter, I'll say a few words and then the interpreter will translate or interpret them in whatever the language is for the client, and then that'll go back and forth. You're saying in this case, you guys go through the hearing, or not you, but the judge goes through the hearing in English, and then there's someone who's called an interpreter that kind of just gives them kind of a Cliff Notes version of what just happened?
Yes.
Hmm. And so how, presenting a defense, I'm scared to ask, but it sounds to me like there's not a big opportunity here for presenting any information back for them to consider.
Well, the interesting thing is right, everything has to be faxed over. So if you have any kind of documents or any kind of evidence or anything, you hand it over to one of the security guards, who would then fax it over to the judge or scan it and email it over to the judge.
But what is there to? But to scan something over. If I'm scared of gang violence, I mean, I'm not. I can't imagine I'm getting a letter from the gang leader saying, "Yeah, we really want to kill this person," and I can take that letter now to the asylum hearing. It would seem like there'd be more. I would call evidence of more of a testimonial in nature that would be what would change someone's mind if they were be willing if they're willing to listen.
Well, I mean, you have to. There is an application for asylum, so there's an actual form that has to get filled out and submitted. So there's, you know, that's one. There's usually an affidavit or a statement from the individual that also gets submitted. There's country reports that get submitted. So I mean, those are the types of things. Some people have medical records. Some people have police reports that they've made in their home country. So I mean, there are some. Some forms of, you know, sometimes there is evidence. You know, if they're claiming that a family member has been killed, they may have a death certificate for that family member. So there is sometimes evidence that, you know, can be provided to the court to verify and confirm what the individual is saying. So, not always. A lot of the times it is based on the credibility of the individual, but sometimes there are pieces of evidence that do exist.
And so does the judge just issue the judge just issues a ruling from the bench, the TV bench, just says a denied or accepted, or how does that work?
Right. So if you, there's two types of hearings in immigration court. The first is called a master calendar hearing. So if you go back to your traffic court analogy, then really it's the docket call, right? That very first docket call. And so the master hearing is basically where, you know, the judge would ask, you know, do you accept the charging documents? Do you accept that you've been given this? Are you asking for asylum? Is there anything else you're asking for? So that kind of procedural back and forth occurs at a master hearing. Now, one thing that is worth noting is that, remember I told you that individuals who came into the country through, let's say, the river would be entitled to be released on, you know, they don't necessarily have to be detained. Well, these charging documents would alter the facts. And so in reality, what they would do is they would say, well, we found you in the country after having crossed the Rio Grande, but the allegation the government would make is that when we push you back into Mexico and then you come to the door with your hearing notice to say, look, I have to go to court, that at that point, in the future, you would have then been classified in the same way as the individual who came to the front door, knocked on the front door, and asked for asylum.
Oh, wow.
So they were factually twisting the facts to fit a legal paradigm that just, it's illogical, number one, because it requires the government to be able to, in the future, predict behavior and make an allegation currently based on future conduct. Which, you know, is alarming at on every level. But that kind of stuff is what was going on.
And so the second hearing, though, and we have 7 minutes, and I apologize, Rick. I want to talk to you for 5 hours, but they only give me an hour or a little bit less. But the second hearing, the one where there's actually a evidentiary hearing, I guess, is the judge pronouncing at that point, you're gone, you're staying, how does that work?
Yeah, you'll put in your evidence and you'll put in your you know, do the trial. Judge is again still not in the courtroom, and the judge is, and now they will tell you that you can as the lawyer make the choice to be in the courtroom with the judge, but then you're not in the courtroom with your client.
Say that one more time. You can be the lawyer could be in the courtroom with the judge wherever the judge is at, but then you wouldn't be with your client. Who would still be who would still be in the tent.
Right.
And so I see. Okay. Wow.
The other thing, and so then they would make a decision. Now, one of the things, the other thing, I know we have very little time, but I think it's important for people to understand, is that, you know, when people show up for their hearings at these courts, they're required to line up at the bridge to cross over from Brownsville or from Matamoros to Brownsville at 4 a.m.
Hmm.
So even if your hearing is at 8 a.m. or 8:30 in the morning or 1 in the afternoon, you are required to be on the bridge at 4 o'clock in the morning. And if you're not there and you later show up, they will not let you into court.
If you, like, you've defaulted, essentially, because you didn't show up at the time you were supposed to?
That's right. And so at that point, they'll say, well, you didn't appear for your court on time, and they can then enter an order without you being present in the courtroom, deporting you from the country.
And are you... Go ahead.
And that does happen a lot of times under, you know, in cases where people don't have lawyers. And there's a lot of cases where people don't have lawyers because lawyers are struggling. You know, if you're in Kansas City, I can't always say, oh, I'm going to go down to Matamoros tomorrow. And then I'll, you know, it just logistically becomes difficult for lawyers across the country.
So, okay. And so then they announce they're right there. And I'm going to put a wild guess here, but it's just a super majority or denied right on the spot. I'm talking about the ones that go through the evidentiary hearing.
Most of them are denied. There were cases where, you know, like if you look at the Brownsville court or the MP court in Brownsville, there were less than 1% were granted.
Less than 1% were granted?
Less than 1% were granted.
And so what happens to and by the way, people are waiting at 4 in the morning. I assume, you know, there's no child care, so I'm waiting at 4 in the morning with my children on a bridge, and I'm eventually ushered into a court. I have a hearing I don't understand, and then I'm pushed when I'm denied, because 99.whatever% are denied. I then push back over the border, and that's it?
And then you can say, well, you can appeal, but you have to wait in Mexico while you appeal.
Wow. It sounds pretty horrific.
Even in cases where people were winning their asylum cases, they were being pushed back into Mexico, given a false hearing date to say, well, come back on this date. Well, there is no hearing date, right? Because they've already won. But they were given a fake date to say, well, come back, you know, your next hearing is going to be on this date. So people who even won their cases sometimes didn't understand they had won because they didn't understand why they have a hearing date.
And then the result is what?
The result is they either don't know what to do or they're stuck in Mexico. And I mean, there's just confusion and chaos that is born out of this procedure that makes no sense.
I see. And I guess, Rekha, we've got another like 2.5 minutes, and I think this is worthy of another show if we have time in the future, which I'm sure we will, and this issue will keep coming up. But why should I, in Kansas City, as a U.S. citizen, care about what's going on in the border with individuals seeking to come into the country? Why is due process there have any impact on what I may expect should I enter any type of justice system here?
Well, David, what I would say is that what's going on in the border is like a death penalty case in traffic court. And we should all be concerned about that type of an erosion on due process, because it's just a matter of time where, you know, if you're allowed to take away fundamental due process rights in that way and at that level, then it's just a matter of time before that trickles down to other things. And I think we have to be concerned for the preservation of those constitutional rights that we all hold dear.
Wow. You know, and it does sound to me almost as that we will be judged ourselves, and I'm not talking even morally. I'm talking about we will physically, you know, legally be judged in a court of law up here by the due process, with the same due process potentially or lack of due process that the individuals at the border are getting, and that is really scary. And that's, I think, where it really touches upon us. Meaning, if individuals coming across claiming asylum, if they get a due process that we are proud of, then if anything, that seems to me that ensures that I will get due process that I think is fair, if God forbid I should be in a position where I have to go before a judge and face a prosecution. Is that what you're saying, Rekha?
Yeah, I think that is what I'm saying. And I think, just in closing, David, what I would say is that, you know, look at the people who are running around under the coronavirus threat, running around, you know, hoarding toilet paper and water. Now, if you're willing to do that in the threat of a virus, imagine if it is your family and it is their life that they are fearing. And, you know, people are often quick to judge, but I think, you know, when you look at it, they are fleeing just as much in the interest of protecting their families as people here are trying to maintain some kind of, you know, take steps to protect their families in light of what's going on.
Wow. Rekha, you, as always, you are an awesome guest, and I always learn so much from you, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you so much, David. I always enjoy these.
Sure. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. We'll see you next time.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following is part of a discussion I had with Norma Sapp, the pioneer of marijuana reform in the state of Oklahoma.
So when people saw the evidence before their eyes of what cannabis does do, then it was a natural progression to move on to allow, well, of course, we voted too. That made it happen. But
yeah.
But to allow it into their brain and for them to understand it better, they now get it that plants can be medicine.
Exactly. Now, this brings to mind one other thought and another component, another tool, I guess, in making these changes happen. And that is, you know the truth about the drug war. You have that leap perspective. You understand that to make it illegal means you're empowering oftentimes criminals, that you're not providing quality, that there's just not any real benefit to the prohibition side, right?
Yes, absolutely. Prohibition has just been an evil war on the people, of course, for 80-something years now. And the damage we have done to families, oh my God. When you take away the breadwinner or even just the mother, it disrupts the whole family for at least two generations and maybe three.
Yeah. It's proven itself to be totally worthless. I think even those who vote in favor of prohibition know it's wrong. Like I always say, they made their bones and they can't back down now.
Well, and so that's exactly what's happening here with criminal justice reform as well. We finally got to the point we could not afford it anymore. And so it wasn't as much as they changed their mind and became compassionate, is that we had to do something. We could not do it without building some more prisons. And we were already spending more than education on locking people up.
Well, we're about to run out of time here, but there was the situation where at the end of last year, you guys released a boatload of prisoners, right?
Yes, and 160 were released yesterday. It was 400 and something at one time, the most that had been released at one time in the nation. But now I think Illinois has released more at once.
Well, and it just shows common sense. It's a wonderful thing to see the change begin. I can't wait till the legislators in Texas pull their heads out of their current place of residence.
Right.
Anyhow, once again, been speaking with my friend Norma Sapp, based in Oklahoma. Norma, closing thoughts, a website you might want to share.
I do Facebook only now, basically, and my name is Norma, NORMASAPP. Find my page and follow me.
I'm Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD.